Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You ever dance with the devil in the pale light? I always ask that of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Baby fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989 from John Goodman's daughter's wedding here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And back with us, fresh off the very thought of you, is the host of the Screen Trash Podcast, all around great guy. Doesn't know this is a surprise podcast, where I'm just going to pitch him new ideas for me on Screen Drafts. Hey, Keller!
Kenny, it's very endearing that you think I would not expect you to pitch me ideas for Screen Drafts topics.
Do you know what I do before I go to bed?
What?
Oh my God.
I think of a Screen Drafts topic and try to do my list.
Are you shadow boxing? Do you have like an imaginary competitor?
No, there's no reason to do that. but when I pitched you Suburbia, you apparently had on your board, I made my list before and make sure that there was a good robust.
What's your number one Suburbia movie?
My number one Suburbia movie? I didn't do it in order. I just
say how high would Penelope Spheeris's Suburbia be?
I you know what? It's on
higher than Richard Linklater's Suburbia.
It's on. It's Penelope Spheeris's Suburbia is the one I know about. Is there a Richard Linklater Suburbia?
It's never been on DVD. Linklater in like 94 or 95 made a movie called Suburbia that's only ever been on VHS and video.
Look at that.
Penelope Spheeris's Suburbia. Yeah.
It is on Suburbia is on iTunes for what it's worth, and it's based on a Bogosian play.
Ooh,
yeah, it's actually.
But Penelope Spheeris's Suburbia is a great movie.
There are so many good fucking suburb movies. Just this is looking at my list real fast.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
And Phil, I say this mostly, you know, as a man after your heart.
Okay.
Probably The Ice Storm.
Yes.
But there's a lot.
So good.
A lot of great flicks.
What better way to start our Sea of Love episode than to talk about a fictional Suburbia Screen Drafts episode that isn't going to happen.
So Sea of Love something. Sea of Love. Oh, look, we will do Suburbia. I just think there's so many facets of Suburbia we may need to subdivide a little bit.
I kept it to 80s and 90s on mine.
We could do it by era. We could do it by genre. There's a lot of ways to do Suburbia. Yeah, yeah. But it is, yep. Phil, it is funny. Sea of Love is could not be less
suburban movie.
Of a suburban movie. Suburban.
So I had never seen Sea of Love before watching it the other day. I knew of Sea of Love. I believe that that my mom likes this movie, feels like that's a thing. I know that this movie holds sort of this weird spot in Pacino's career, sort of the fulcrum point of, you know, he was apparently considering just walking away from film entirely at this point. Diane Keaton convinces him to do this film, which is interesting. And this film was a success. Brought him back, you know, his career, you know, obviously has gone on for many decades since. And it's interesting that this is that movie. Like, it's kind of a weird movie and I'm excited to talk about it. But how did, I know Clay that you're a big Sea of Love fan and I'm wondering how it came into your life and why you picked it.
I do not remember why I picked it. So I worked for a long time at a video store. I mean, I know why I picked it for your show. I don't remember why I picked it up initially to watch it. I worked at Vidiot's in Santa Monica for many years. And, you know, when you're working at a video store, you just have lots of time to just look at all the fucking boxes that are on the shelf. And it might have been, no, you know what? I do remember what it was. Okay, so actually, honestly, shout out to Jason Mantzoukas on How Did This Get Made? It was an episode years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. They were talking about maybe Color of Night, Bruce Willis.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. One of the worst movies ever made.
Terrible movie. Yeah.
And I want to say Jason Mantzoukas was saying, you know, if you want a good, like, I love this genre, you want a good erotic thriller, you know, mystery like this, watch Sea of Love. Not to me. I wasn't a guest on the show.
Yes, I understand.
I was a listener. But I acted like he was speaking directly to me. And I took his recommendation.
Right.
And I watched Sea of Love. And I had a blast with it. And then several years later, is maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, at the Arrow, they showed a double feature of Harold Becker movies. Starting both on 35, starting with Sea of Love, followed by Malice, which is a movie I adore.
That's a great crazy movie.
Yeah. Was a wonderful double feature, but it was all the more special. They had Becker there and Al Pacino was there for a Q&A afterwards. And usually Q&As are awful. My friend Ryan Marker, who I co-host Screen Drafts with, is the manager of the Arrow. He moderated the Q&A. It was a great Q&A. Pacino was a delight. He got there early. He watched the movie, which, as you guys know, Q&A guests almost never do.
Yeah, no.
He watched the movie, and then when it was done, Full House, he like trotted down the aisle and was like, "Hey!" It's like, "Whoa, that's a good movie." He's like, "I love watching a movie in a theater with people." It's like, it seemed like he hadn't done that in however long. And he was just stoked. So much so that by the end of the Q&A, he was pitching Ryan other movies they could show that he could come back and do Q&As for.
What? Wow.
One of the best Q&As I've ever seen. Anyway, had a great time watching it. I love the drum I always beat is that rep theaters need to play more 80s and 90s studio movies because I have so many opportunities to see, you know, God love it, but I've seen Rosemary's Baby in rep 15 times.
Sure.
There's certain movies you do not run out of opportunities to see in rep, and I love all those movies. Mm-hmm. But the movies you never get to see in rep, and for people like me who were too young to see them in the theaters, these movies, and I've said this to you, Phil, before, Crimson Tide, I would sell a kidney to see Crimson Tide in a movie theater. Yeah. And it's just never going to happen.
It's funny. We were talking about this, obviously, on the previous episode we recorded, but Backdraft is another one that I never got to see on the big screen. I bet that movie looks fucking great on a big screen.
Stuff that would play that, you know, people at the time took for granted and would play. They are big screen movies, but because they're not fancy, you never get to see them. However, in this case, Harold Becker was there. Both of these movies are movies like that, Sea of Love and Malice. And I was just like, I was happy as a pig in shit. It could not have been a better night for me. I fucking loved it.
You know, it's funny. I I sent both of you the poster for this film, which I think is a phenomenal poster. Might argue that the poster might be better than the movie, and the movie's quite good, I think. But the poster is, I think it's a great poster. It almost looks like a Bond poster, and it's a weird movie for Al Pacino to be the lead in. Like it is sort of like I said that in the best way. Like it's got this kind of like blue collary cop thing, which I do think works for Pacino, but there's this kind of sweeping old school, you know, femme fatale thing, which is not really how I see Al Pacino.
Yeah, it's a Michael Douglas role, but
which
is fine. Like, yeah. I mean, but I'm gonna give you my thing with
this movie.
Yeah. This movie is a little bit famous for people who have read Save the Cat, because this is the movie that Blake, what's his name? The guy who wrote Blake Snyder.
I did not know this. Okay.
Who wrote Save the Cat used as an example of saving the cat to be like, it's not simply saving the cat. The reason you get on with Al Pacino in this movie is because he tells that criminal who brings his kid to the fake Yankees thing to go away. And you're like, all right, this guy has a heart. This guy is decent. This guy is out, you know, for good, but he's not going to embarrass the guy.
It's a great moment.
It is. And, you know, that you know, I think everyone has their issues with screenplay manuals and whatever. I feel very strongly you should read them all and then disregard what doesn't work for you. But
it's fair.
But I think that I've always kind of known about this movie because of that. I never watched this movie until sometime during the pandemic, which could have been a year ago or a month ago. I have no concept. It was on Pluto, my favorite. I love catching random shit. Pluto is the repertory theater you're talking about, Clay, where like you can catch all this crazy, obviously not on a big screen, but you can catch all this stuff that you'd think that it's all, you know, people who've been to Pluto know this is the case, but you'd think it basically be all bargain basement garbage shit. There is so much great stuff on there. And I caught this on Pluto from the beginning. And really loved it, like I'm like, oh, this movie is so for me. But it was, you know, 11 o'clock and I felt like I was, you know, finding something and it all kind of worked and I wasn't paying that much attention. And I think the more attention you pay to this movie, the more it falls apart. And I think this movie has kind of fallen apart for me. However, there's a lot to love. And
I just
want to say one more thing. 1989 New York City it's who I want to marry. I love my wife, but I would rather marry 1989 New York City.
It's like, a very New York movie.
Yeah. It is there's something about that time right before Giuliani, even before Dinkins, that like end of the Koch era where the city like knew it had to do better. Like there was this thing where they're like, we can't be Taxi Driver New York. We can't be XXX theaters on every corner of New York. We can't be Crackhead New York. We can't be Graffiti New York. But like that is New York. So these two things were fighting each other so hard. And I fucking love that New York. So that really like, I mean, I just, the first thing I wrote in my notes is just like, I could bathe in the visuals of this movie.
Yeah. The credit sequence alone, you're just like, it's amazing. But it's what I was going to say before you said that, Kenny, was, so I started watching it and as we can all attest, like the credits, you're just like, fuck yes. Right. Like got Richard Jenkins and Michael Rooker, you know, sharing a credit together and you're just like, I'm in. Like whatever. Like
dangerous,
the fuck
sexy saxophone music.
It's just great. It's great. And I texted Kenny and I was like, this is fucking great. And Kenny's like, yeah, it's awesome. I'm halfway through it. And then he watched the other half, I'm assuming at a later date, and texted me and was like, yeah, so maybe not so much. And I was like, listen, I'm totally into talk about the the strengths and weaknesses of this film. Obviously, that's what we do. But yeah.
I didn't want to mislead Phil and make him think that I was going to come on here and
I appreciated that. I appreciate yes. that. Yeah. So what I think is interesting about the Save the Cat thing that you talk about, Kenny, is that Ebert dings this film, and I'll read his review in a second, about the twist at the end, and that it feels, and we're going to jump all over the place.
Highly dingable.
A fair ding, but I'll say this. Ebert makes it sound as though this character comes out of nowhere and is just a total deus ex machina. It is, and it isn't, right? Like, the guy does, Michael Rooker does have a couple scenes before the reveal at the end. So it's not as though it's a complete out of the blue, but it does feel like it's enough out of the blue that you kind of go like, wait a second, what's going on? Like, it has to backfill a lot, which is not generally a good thing when it comes to your
reveal. And it also lays on the Ellen Barkin did this so thick.
It's true.
That both of the potential endings would have been problematic.
Yes.
Right? The ending where she did it would have been better.
Interesting.
That at least kind of gets to something like, you know, emotional. And I strongly feel like what Pacino did in this movie is crazy. And he should not be rewarded for it. And I don't mean crazy like I don't believe it. I believe it. I watch this movie. I see Ellen Barkin in this movie. I get it. But like, it's nuts. And he should not be rewarded for it. And he is totally rewarded for it.
So. I don't disagree with that. I'm going to give a quick synopsis here. Let's give a little bit of context and then we'll dive into it. But troubled New York City detective Frank Keller, played by Al Pacino, investigates a serial killer who finds victims using personal ads in a magazine and leaves the song Sea of Love playing at crime scenes. With the help of his partner, Sherman Tuohy, played by John Goodman, Frank concocts a plan to find the killer using his own personal ads. But when Frank falls for one of his chief suspects, Helen Kruger, played by Ellen Barkin, he struggles to reconcile his personal life and his professional duty. Written by Richard Price, who's a great novelist and wrote on The Wire. He's a tremendous writer. And directed by Harold Becker, Sea of Love opened on September 15th, 1989 in first place with $10 million ahead of Uncle Buck, Parenthood, When Harry Met Sally, and a Kenny favorite, Kickboxer. It would go on to make $110 million on a $19 million budget, which
Whoa.
Is, in 1989, $110 million is, that's a yes. lot of money.
Insane.
Is that not insane?
I am shocked by that. Considering that people, considering that it is not a staple.
At all.
Those are huge numbers.
That's huge.
It's not even considered top tier Pacino.
No. Like $110 million is the equivalent of about $350 probably today.
That must be worldwide.
It is worldwide, but still.
Well, let's see where it landed on the list. 16.
In terms of the,
Twins is a 1989 movie.
Maybe Phil, it's an 88 movie.
It's an 88 that carried over.
Yeah, I think so.
It's between Twins and Pet Sematary above the Abyss.
Yeah.
You know, above Christmas Vacation, above
The Working Abyss, Girl. A famous underperformer.
Correct. Yeah.
But a movie that has persisted. Yes. Right? Like Major League obviously has persisted. Beaches, number one BFFF movie of all time.
Yep.
A lot of movies have persisted. Correct. And Sea of Love
doesn't maybe, really.
It doesn't also, you know, look, the title does it no favors.
I agree. It's interesting too, because like Pacino follows up this film with Dick Tracy in 1990, and I believe is it Glengarry Glenn Ross in 90 as well? Maybe I'm making that up.
Glengarry Glenn Ross might be like 92.
Might be 91 or 92, yeah. But
well,
I know that
before
Dick Tracy,
after Scent of a Woman.
Scent of a Woman might is shortly
thereafter.
That's 91.
As well.
I think Scent of a Woman is after this.
But the thing is, this obviously gives him new life and obviously kind of propels certainly a large swath of his career. Roger Ebert gives the film 3 stars, says, First of all, Sea of Love has 76% of Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 66 from audiences. Ebert says Sea of Love tells an ingeniously constructed story that depends for its suspense on the same question posed by Jagged Edge and Fatal Attraction. What happens when you fall in love with a person who may be quite prepared to murder you? The movie stars Al Pacino looking older and a little lined, but more convincing than in most of his other recent roles as a homicide detective who is assigned to a messy murder case. The victim is a male who's been shot in his own bed, and the killer, it appears, was a woman. Movies like this need to work on two levels. The human element should feel right, and the initial complications of the plot should not be shortchanged at the end. I think the ending of Sea of Change cheats by bringing in a character from left field at the last moment. Part of the fun in a movie like this is guessing the identity of the killer, and part of the problem with Sea of Love is that the audience is not fairly treated. Technically, I suppose the plot can be justified, but I felt cheated. I had good feelings for the characters and the relationships, but I walked out feeling the plot played fast and loose with the rules of whodunits. Still gave it 3 out of 4 stars. So, like, I think there's more good than bad here, but I do understand that.
I think there's more good than bad, and we get to this if your Patreon episodes follow the same structure as the regular episodes. Yes. We will get to the plot ranking and stuff all that at the end. But even though I do love this movie, I've seen it now 3 times because I rewatched it last night as well. Yeah. To your point, Kenny, halfway through, you're so jazzed because it is so much better than that type of movie usually is at the beginning. And I think it sets up the expectation a little too high, because then at the end, I don't think it's any worse than your boilerplate erotic thriller conclusion. But it does definitely, in relation to how high the peak the movie hits in the middle, it does feel a little bit pedestrian at the end when you get to Michael Rooker and him having a fucking punch fight.
Well, part of it too is the Richard Price component, right? Like, Richard Price is bringing so much complexity to Pacino's character as well as Barkin's character. But Pacino is... I mean, there's a three-dimensionality there. There's a sadness. There's a brokenness. There's this sort of depth of a guy who's really circling the drain, which is, really kind of Richard Price's,
right?
That's his lane. And he does it so well that, to your point, the boilerplate plotty parts of it almost feel beneath Richard Price. You know what I mean? So it's like you do feel that weird kind
only of at the end, I think. Like, I think the idea of let's do personal ads and then have the whole, like, second act, they keep doing these, like, like, set up dates with Pacino and Goodman pretending to be on dates with these women, all stuff. That is all very, I think, ingenious. It's fantastic.
I think Clay, you're nailing it. So basically, this movie is great, not even for the first half. This movie is incredible for 90% of it. 90% of this movie is incredible, but you can't ignore that everything has to be recalibrated by the reveal at the end, which is Ellen Barkin isn't actually dangerous.
Right.
And if Ellen Barkin isn't actually dangerous, then it does call into question what was happening throughout the entire film. Because she does so many things that a dangerous person would do, right? And I don't think that's a misreading on Pacino's character's part or on the audience's part. I do think it feels like we have to keep this person very much alive as a suspect. So that, that is why I was kind of pitching the Fatal Attraction ending. Where she actually is dangerous. But I'm already, like, hedging way more towards, like, there's so much about this movie that I deeply loved that I can kind of ignore the end that was kind of lame and feels a little tacked on. Like, there are two things that I deeply love about this movie, aside from the things we talked about, the look of it, the production design, all that shit.
Yeah.
I deeply love the relationship between Pacino and Goodman. I really, really like seeing a movie that they're not partners when they start,
yep,
but they're decent towards each other, right? Pacino yeah. isn't looking down on him because he's from an outer borough. Goodman isn't, you know, some insecure rookie. They're two pros.
They like each other immediately.
Yeah. Immediately.
Which is so fun. The great line at that, like, policeman's ball or whatever yeah. that is, where John Goodman is, again, John Goodman singing into his beer bottle and doing his striptease.
Doing his Goodman
like,
stuff. Yeah.
No one can do that as good as John Goodman. And then Pacino goes, I just met this guy.
It's true. They have a bromance from the word go.
Yep.
And I just appreciate so much a buddy cop movie that isn't a you know up and back love story between totally. The two guys. And I say that, you know, yep. platonically. Second thing I love mm-hmm. is Ellen Barkin's performance. Yep. I kind of can't get the image of Ellen Barkin pushing Pacino up against the wall and taking control of that sex scene. Mm-hmm. That is so unusual. That is a really vulnerable position for Pacino, the actor, to put himself in.
Totally.
This was not who Ellen Barkin was going into this. Ellen Barkin was a sweet girl from Diner. Right? Yeah. This is a whole new scene, a whole new look for her. Mm-hmm. And her characterization is just so striking and affecting. So everything is like so fucking perfect, firing on all cylinders. And then I do think it kind of loses its way in the end. And I do think they should have, you know, done another kind of given it another look on what might be a more satisfying ending. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's one of those things where plot machinations fall to the wayside and characterization comes, you know, comes up. And I really do yeah. think that I'm going to go up quite a bit when I give my grade.
Well, and it's one of those movies where, look, I'd seen this movie twice and I own it on home video. And if before I rewatched it yesterday, you had asked me, how does the movie end? I would have been like, fuck, how does it end? Like, I would remember that Ellen Barkin wasn't the killer, but it would have right. taken me a while to remember, like, oh yeah, Rooker like attacks him in his apartment and they yeah. fight. What I could recite from like memory totally. Is every other scene in the movie.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's weird, but I am the same way because I watched and I, you know, Rooker's a face you know, and I, all right, that's interesting. This random guy is random guy. I couldn't remember he was the killer. Yeah. You know? So that's you're right.
I want to just take a second to talk about Ellen Barkin, who has talked about this film. And I just want to read a little bit of she was interviewed in 2011, said that the film was not her best work and didn't think that Harold Becker liked her, but that this movie did make her a household name. The article also says that Barkin said that she was forced into doing the sensual grocery store scene where she caresses yellow peppers while wearing little under her raincoat other than a sly thigh to entice Al Pacino. Barkin said she had a big fight with Becker over it since she really didn't want to do it. Pacino was brilliant and very generous to work with, but the reason it's hard for her to watch is when she sees Sea of Love, that the audience sees an attitude on her part when really she sees a tenseness. But through her training in method acting at the Actors Studio, she made that tenseness in the scene work for her in front of the camera when in fact she was quite, you know, unhappy.
Is it because the scene is like kind of campy and silly? Because that's not like a particularly reveal. I mean, there's the sex scene is certainly much more.
Oh, it's obviously. I wonder whether or not because the scene is a little silly.
That is a silly scene, like a charmingly silly scene, but absolutely right. a silly scene.
But I don't know that Harold Becker thinks it's silly. Oh. I guess is the point I'm trying to make. Sure. Like we watch it now and we're like, it's coy. And I think that Ellen finds a way to make it seem playful because I think Becker wants it to be like a straight up, like hot scene.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's stupid.
No, they both show up wearing like all black and then they stalk yeah. each other around the bodega.
But like all I saw during that scene was bodega.
It's just like bodega.
No, totally. Yeah.
No, but it's so interesting
to be in a bodega at night. Oh.
The weird dichotomy in this movie, and I don't know if it's weird is not the right word. The unexpected and I think actually yeah. ultimately very interesting dichotomy is it is playing at being an erotic thriller.
Yes,
but in actuality, and I think this is what complicates the idea of making her the killer at the end, is it is really kind of a tender, it turns into a tender love story about these two sort of lost souls who are past. I mean, I don't know how old Ellen Barkin is supposed to be in this. She sort of implies that, and certainly at the time, she's got a kid, she's divorced, she's past her prime relative to the situation. Like that, Pacino is a drunk, sad guy in his, you know, late 40s, looking at retirement. His like widowed drunk father hangs out with him. Again, full of every moment of this movie has character detail. This is such a rich world that this movie exists in. And
it's also cast, like every role, like John Spencer showing up for like two scenes.
Oh my God.
Like just real, so the depth of roles.
Yeah, but I was saying, like, it turns into a real love story.
Yes.
It's not Fatal Attraction. You know, it's not Basic Instinct. It is, these are two very much more real, grounded, earthy feeling people who you could envision them figuring shit out together. And then I think you couldn't have her be the killer at the end and get that type of love. I think he wanted the love story. Yep. He wanted it to be almost a misdirect erotic thriller that turns into a real love story. But again, as Kenny said, then you need, you know, and as Phil said, and as Ebert said in his review, then tying it, you know, going on that very interesting romantic, sincere diversion, and then having to like hard whip the wheel of a car around at the last 10 minutes and go way back into like, oh, we forgot we were an erotic thriller. There has to be someone who dies. There's got to be a fight and a death at the end. And you're like, oh, I guess it's Rooker. I mean, the clues add up. It is someone who is clearly in her orbit doing this. But yeah, no, it feels a little bit out of nowhere because the movie for 25, 30 minutes, spend so much time trying to be this like authentic love story.
I do think it was poorly calibrated. It went too far in the direction that she did it as a red herring. If you had the opposite, if she did do it, you probably would have written it the other way. And you would have gone, sweet love story, sweet love story, sweet love story. Oh, she's underneath it. She's a psycho killer.
Sure.
You know, because everyone's boring, and that's just the arc of what we do with these kind of movies. But I do think it does kind of hurt the story that you're talking about, Clay. Like, I do think it does kind of undercut a romance between two kind of sweet people. Because I don't see that from her, really. Though there are a lot of things in this movie that do, if you do think she's the killer, do undercut that in a good way, right? They like, why is she even talking to this guy when she finds out he's a cop, if she's the killer, right? Why is she letting him into the shoe store? Why is she being seen with him anywhere? Why isn't she just killing him earlier? Why isn't she disappearing? So... There are these things.
But those things made me even the first time I saw this, after the bit with the starter pistol where he freaks out, which is a very funny scene. Again, there's a lot of great, when he like locks her in the closet, there's a lot of great humor in this movie.
Well, this is kind of Pacino's first funny movie.
There is a line when she finds out he's a cop and gets mad at him, and then he gets hyper defensive about being a cop. There is a line that, I mean, it is the origin of what would become his entire, it is the seed that turned into Scent of a Woman, that turned into everything else. Yeah. When he says, in the wet ass hour, I'm everyone's daddy, which is a fucking crazy line and a crazy way to say it. I had to rewind it and put the subtitles on. I was like, did he say in the wet ass hour, I'm everyone's dad, everybody's daddy? In any case,
that is the way.
I forgot what I was talking about. Oh, I never thought she was the killer. I never thought in any time I watched this movie, I never thought she was the killer.
I love that Kenny thinks that. Did you say that's how every cop thinks?
That's how every cop thinks.
In the wet ass?
Well, that's the end of the monologue.
They don't say the wet ass hour, but every cop thinks. Every cop thinks you hate me now, but you know, you get your house robbed. Who are you going to call?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, not the craziest way to think. because it is true.
But the line is crazy, and the way Pacino says it is just
insane. I agree with you, Clay. That is the seed from which the crazy Pacino tree blossomed. It is, but it's fun. Like, I think this is when Pacino, because you look at his IMDb, like we said.
Yep.
He really had no 80s, right?
Nope. Revolution was a crazy disaster. Like, I didn't even know that film existed until I did a little bit of a deep dive. Did you guys know about this movie, Revolution?
No, I didn't know. I knew of it. I've never seen it.
So it's like, it's an American Revolution movie that I guess was set up at a studio. Eventually they passed. The producer got the script and went out to a bunch of people to try to sell it again, sells it to a studio. And the thing is just an unmitigated flop. Like, it makes like a pittance of its like $50 million budget. And Pacino goes on a 4-year hiatus after that. So that's why the 80s kind of get away from him.
So you look at Pacino's career, and Pacino, the thing people don't realize about Pacino is young Pacino was gorgeous, right? Yep. Like, he was like the best looking man.
Yep.
And you look at the Revolution poster, you know, he does Scarface in 83. Look at the Revolution poster. He's still pretty Pacino.
Yep.
He disappears for 4 years, and something happened in those 4 years that turned him into old, crazy Pacino. And he is no longer, even the movies when he's playing, you know, criminals or drug addicts like Panic in Needle Park, he's still pretty. But then something happens where he is no longer your typical leading man. And for some reason, whether he doesn't take the roles or whether Hollywood just, he's like, I couldn't possibly cast you as a leading man anymore in a classic romance. They recognize this, and he recognized this. And I think almost every movie Pacino does, maybe with the exception of Heat.
I was just going to say, he's hot in Heat.
He's just not joking in Heat, right? But like every other movie he does, and I'm just looking at his shit right now, The Insider, I don't think he's joking in. Everything else, he is joking.
Yeah.
He is just having a fucking blast out there.
It's all the devil's advocate times.
Yes,
like,
he's here to make you laugh.
The devil's advocate.
And it starts with this movie. And you know, I don't know what, Clay, like in the wet ass hour, I'm everybody's daddy in the theater in 1989, going to see Pretty Boy from fucking Serpico must have knocked people on their ass.
And beyond that, you know, yes, to your point about him not being sexy anymore, this character, and again, inconsistent with Michael Douglas, could not play this guy. This guy is a bum. They make jokes about how short he is from the beginning of the movie. Everyone in the movie is taller than he is by about a foot. His suits are like weirdly long, which makes him also look shorter. Like, he's slumping his shoulders. Like, he is supposed to be kind of a sad sack.
His hair is terrible. There is this scene when he calls his ex-wife, who's played by Lorraine Bracco, who is cut from the movie, but for the television versions has been reinserted into it, but that's whatever. Sure. When he calls
her, gotta get to it 2 hours.
Yeah. He's been cucked by Richard Jenkins.
But he calls her in the middle of the night, and it's so fucking sad. She straight up hangs up on him. Like, it's just, it's a really, like, this guy is truly pathetic.
He's a truly good guy. Like, the bigger save the cat scene even than the beginning one is the one with the old lady.
Oh,
where
that scene, you know, fucking killed me. That scene was really sad.
Oh man,
he starts his speed dating thing to get the women who reply to this ad.
Yeah.
The first one is with an older lady, an attractive older lady. He's very nice to her, and you even get the sense that, like, you know, in a real world where he, you know, is actually meeting people, he might even like date her. Yeah. She gets a sense very quickly that she is being ignored yet again and hangs out at the bar. And after she's seen him date 4 or 5 other women on this sting operation, leaves with a tear rolling down her face. He just gives this little,
it's brutal.
I don't see anything else about it. And a worse movie would have him catch up with her later and make it right somewhere.
Yeah. Or they'd turn it into a joke. She'd throw a drink in his face or something.
Yeah. It's just something awful. But there's just a moment of humanity. And, you know, what I really love about Pacino in this film and this character and the characterization and the setting is, in order to live in Manhattan, You either need to be insanely wealthy or single. And single and with a job, right? Insanely wealthy, or you know, single with a job. And if you are 45 and single with a job, you know, to each their own, but a pretty good chance you feel like something's not going right. And like he has this like sadness, this I'm playing out the string thing to him.
Yep.
You know, retirement breathing down his neck, that may as well be death to a 46-year-old guy. It's brutal, but it's a very New York-y story to me, a very Manhattan-y story to me. Yep. That, you know, in the outer boroughs, it doesn't quite have the same thing, right? In other places, it doesn't, like you're just kind of choosing to hang on in the lowest rung of the ladder in Manhattan, which is a tough place to be.
Yeah, it's, he's just, you highlighted that scene with the older lady at that. There is something silently so sad about Pacino in this. He's always been a very good actor. He can always sort of tell a story without a line. But in this movie in particular, I think it's what you're talking about, Kennedy. You sort of, this idea of him going away for 4 years and coming back weathered, you know, like his face has just become so much more richly kind of detailed, in the sense of this guy's been through some shit, whatever it is, who knows. But like, he's got these dark circles under his eyes. He's pale. His hair's a mess. He's just living in a kind of a shitty apartment. It's so when Ellen Barkin enters the film, which by the way is 45 minutes into this film, like she enters late in this movie.
Yeah.
She's a breath of fresh air. Like you can understand why this guy fell for her hard and quickly. She looks unbelievable in this film, but also just has this energy. She crackles in a way that's just unreal.
Yeah. And she's got a hard edge that she is not like
a New Yorker too.
She's a New, she feels like, look, I think Ellen Barkin is as striking as you guys do, but she, again, we talked about Julia Roberts a lot on the
Very Thought of You,
Very Thought of You episode, which I don't know if people listening to this, if these are whatever, near each other in any way, shape or form, but Ellen Barkin is not Jessica Lange. Like she doesn't look like she was designed to be on the cover of a magazine. She's got a hard edge to her look, which is more dynamic and interesting in a lot of ways, but also makes her feel a lot more real. I buy her as a downtrodden, down on her luck, hardened by a hard life in the city, single mother.
Yep.
I buy it, and I buy that those two people would be attracted to each other.
No, it's funny because we talked about this with Monica Potter, that, you know, in an airport, she wouldn't really stand out to me. And I think Monica Potter's, you know, more classically, traditionally, you know, beautiful by Anglo-Saxon standards. But Ellen Barkin would, you know, she walks in out of this movie. Helen Kruger walks into any room in the world and the room stops because she's got that thing.
She's got it.
And she walks into the bar, right? And the bar kind of stops. Even though it's not like it's like some, you know, parade of unattractive women walking in, it's just a parade of people. Mm-hmm. But she, and then on top of that, she immediately high statuses him.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? I love a big faith meanie. So she immediately high statuses him, immediately makes him feel like a little man, immediately says, I'm not going to play your game. And yes, I would run after, fuck this thing. Yeah. It's over. You think I'm garbage? Tell me more.
Yeah, she's really, really, really good in this. And I mean, despite the, you know, whatever drama there was on set, she does weaponize all of it to create a really striking performance. So I just want to talk about John Goodman for a quick second here, because this is the second 1989 movie we have of John Goodman, the other being everyone's favorite Steven Spielberg film, Always.
Always.
And he kind of plays, I don't want to say a similar role, but he does play the friend. He does play the number two in both of those films. this film is obviously much, much better than Always, but it also just, you know, John Goodman has been on Roseanne for many years up until this point, right? Like, I'm assuming he's been on there for a few seasons, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know when Roseanne premiered.
A couple,
But he's got that blue-collar dad kind of everyman quality about him. I mean, he literally plays Fred Flintstone a few years later, which is, you know, again, sort of the quintessential everyman, I guess. but Goodman in this... It's you guys, you highlighted it earlier, the first time he meets Pacino and that immediate chemistry that the two of them have. They seem like they had so much fun together. Like, you just, the impression is that they were just buds from the jump and it works. I totally buy John Goodman as like a cop from, is he in Queens? Where was he from? And I don't know what borough it was.
That's where the wedding is. I think
it is Queens.
He does say Queens. He's like, Hugh Gardens, they say like, do you want to work out of out of here? Out. He's like, yeah,
right.
But Queens.
Right. Yeah, it's so he's fantastic in it, and we're gonna do our top seven out of honor to screen drafts. Our top seven John Goodmans at the end of the episode, so we can talk a little bit more about him and his career. But this is just an interesting kind of moment when John Goodman. This is the beginning of John Goodman as solid, you know, supporting character above the title John Goodman. And it's just
casting John Goodman is a choice, right? Yes. John Goodman is not your everyman best friend. Mm-hmm. John Goodman at some point is going to hold a beer bottle up to his mouth, do a, you know, lip sync or actually sing and do a little bit of striptease. And is your movie big enough for that? Like, can your movie handle what John Goodman is going to bring to your movie? And not that he's some kind of scenery chewing actor.
Yep.
That's not what I mean.
Yep.
He just like, he is a thing. He is a presence.
He's a force of nature.
He's a force of nature. But, you know, pretty much always, I can't think of a movie that, you know, runs to the contrary, a welcome presence. Like,
for sure.
He's a big hug of a man.
Well, we talked a little bit about this on our Uncle Buck episode because he was apparently in the running for that to play the titular Uncle Buck. And, you know, I can see that movie. That movie makes sense. It's not the same energy, but like, you know, it could have worked.
But that's what's so cool about John Goodman is, and what's so unique about him and the way they use him in this and the way he's been able to sort of curate his persona as a big dude. I mean, he calls himself fat in this movie in a very funny when the woman says, your skin is so tight. He says, oh, it's because I'm fat.
It's like a tire.
He is not a goo. He's not a joke. He's not a punchline. No. He's not a schlub. He's not Uncle Buck. Yep. He is kind of sexy in this movie. I mean, he cheats on his wife, but he scores this date with this woman. You know, he is cool. He is the cool big fat guy. And I don't know if any other, you know, plus size actor.
Yeah.
I can't think of one who managed to be plus size, but their persona is not that they are, God love John Candy, but he played a lot of roles where the joke was that he was a fat slob goof punchline. Yeah. And Goodman never really succumbed to that.
It's incredible because Goodman has boss energy, right?
Yeah.
And that's amazing considering he played second banana to Roseanne, who has the biggest boss energy like ever. Yep. But to be able to basically make something out of that role, Dan Connor, that wasn't just, you know, the husband to the star, is kind of, you know, incredible in its own right. But and then what you're saying, Clay, is amazing too. I think you're hitting on John Goodman as sexy. I've heard that. I've heard that many times, that women find John Goodman to be very sexy, which is, you know, that's something that I can't really think of. Yeah, the other guy who's a big guy who women loved was Gandolfini. But it's the same thing, right? Yeah. It comes from the same place. It's this boss energy, you know? And it's not even the thing where you have a bigger guy who's like, you better not make fun of me. You know?
Right, right.
You'd never even think with those guys. You'd never even think to like go down that road with those two. So I think they're almost yin and yang of a similar character type.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, I mean he's really good in the movie. He's very lovable. I agree with you that that his range, and you know, we'll talk about it when we get to our favorite John Goodmans at the end, but like the guy's got legit range. It's not just, you know,
oh yeah,
Dan Connor. It's pretty incredible stuff. So we'll jump into the plot. The film opened with something that I was genuinely perplexed by. I did not understand what was happening with this Meet the Yankees brunch.
Great scene.
And apparently it really happened too, that apparently they did do this. I don't know why, but apparently this apprehension of criminals by arranging a Meet the Yankees breakfast was based on a real event from New York.
Fucking idiots.
Sam Jackson is one of those criminals.
He is. Gets all the lines.
You got Sam Jackson. You got Paul Calderon in this movie. You got some Pulp Fiction folks.
It's great. So they bust all these cops, and then Kenny mentioned the not cops, criminals. Kenny mentioned the sort of save the cat moment, which is afterwards. There's this guy who walks up with his daughter, and Pacino, rather than busting the guy for, I think it was 2 Grand Theft Auto charges, lets him go to show he's a nice guy.
And he says, catch you later.
Yes.
Which he says to Barkin later.
Yes.
So I guess that's his little, you know, hasta la vista, baby, that he's in criminals. That he's just not in the mood to book him right there. But, you know,
Sea of Love 2,
the tagline is ... It's later.
That's fantastic. He does flash his badge, whether it's intentional.
He lets the guy know. Yeah,
he kind of flashes
because the
badge.
Guy's like, "Hey, no, don't turn me away. I want to meet the Yankees."
Yeah. He's like, and then he's like, "Get the fuck out of here." Mm-hmm. So then Frank Keller has just reached his 20th year on the police force, and he's investigating the murder of a man in Manhattan, shot dead while face down in his bed, naked, listening to an old 45 of Sea of Love. There are three.
I love Sea of Love.
I love Sea of Love. I love a movie, any movie. It's a great song, and it's a great like love song that's also creepy if you listen to it too much.
Yeah, like Blue Velvet.
It's a Blue Velvet, and it's. I have another connection as well.
But I mean, like the song,
it's like Blue Velvet. Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. And I love a movie that has a recurring musical motif like that. I'm a big like iconography guy, but this is, I don't know what the word for that with music is. It's aurilography or it's whatever. But it's I love that when movies have things like that they commit to, where like this is going to be a signature of the movie that you can remember later. I like things that have signatures. An interesting thing with Sea of Love is that song has always felt creepy to me, because the first PG-13 movie I ever saw in movie theaters was Gregory Hoblit's Frequency.
Interesting.
And in Frequency, there is
like the Jim Caviezel movie?
The Jim Caviezel, Dennis Quaid movie, where they're time travel serial killer hunting.
I like that flick.
Oh, good movie. Yeah. That's a good movie.
Yeah.
There's a very creepy scene where Dennis Quaid is trying to stop a serial killer. He gets beat up. And then when he comes to, he tries to chase after, comes to the scene of the crime too late. The woman's dead. And on the record player, Sea of Love is skipping. Do you remember? It's skipping on that. The person who was originally going to direct Sea of Love, Gregory Hoblit.
Oh, look at that.
One of the things that I love about the 45 too is in the scene later when Pacino is talking to his police chief, played by John Spencer, he says the reason that he knows the killer didn't know the victim is because he's playing 45s, and that you would only play 45s if you're trying to woo somebody. Once you know them, you don't give a shit anymore, which I think is a fantastic... That felt very Richard Pricey to me. Like, there's something very kind of like... real about that. Very genuine.
It's like that Blu-ray. It's like that Blu-ray collection behind you, Phil.
Yeah, it's like those Criterions that I only play.
You only bust out the Criterions when you're trying to woo somebody.
As a third date, fourth date,
You know. No, but and Phil, to that point, this movie again. I mentioned having a really rich world, and not only is the dialogue great and very character based, these characters are all really dynamic. Every single moment of this movie has something that feels authentic and real. And a lot of movies, the neighbor lady who finds the body would just find the body and then be like, oh, there's the body. Oh, okay. In this movie, he walks up. The way this scene plays out is he walks up to the apartment. Two uniformed cops come out laughing. Mm-hmm. He's like, what? Yeah. Walks in and finds the old lady telling a story about to these other cops, and they're
smoking cigs.
There's the cigarettes. She told a story about a boxer. I'm forgetting who it was. And they're like, you saw him box live? She's like, oh,
Joe Lewis.
God.
Yeah.
Joe Lewis. And it's this whole little universe that's happening. And most other movies, that character, that woman would have nothing to fucking do. And 100%. Every character like that in this movie has something to do, has a life that is hinted at. And it just makes the whole thing feel more real. And it just puts you in. I love when movies do that. And this movie does it.
Yeah, 100%.
Well.
And that's very much a Richard Price thing. I mean, if you've read any of his books, every single character has a richly detailed world. They have a life of their own. Obviously, all the stuff that he did on The Wire as well.
Yeah.
It's just, and I love that scene as well when they're talking to the old lady, and then when Pacino grabs one of the cigarette butts and is like, "Can you please not contaminate the crime scene?" Like, it's a really, I couldn't agree with you more. This is the stuff that in a lesser writer's hands and in a lesser director's hands would just feel. It's just
perfunctory. There's nothing perfunctory in this.
Exactly.
You know, I mentioned this before. My cousin's a cop, and he has said to me that, you know, it's like anybody who has a profession thinks the movies about that profession have no idea the way it really works. Mm-hmm. And he said to me the only two shows that get it right are The Wire and Barney Miller. I have a sense. Yeah. I have a sense, and I should have asked him before that, because he's a big film guy and all that stuff. I have a sense that this gets it pretty close to right too. You know, I have a sense that the rhythms, the way they talk to each other, the policeman's ball, the way you worry about retirement, the jocular kind of don't contaminate the evidence thing, not the slapping down, the laughing, leaving the crime scene, like you mentioned, Clay. I think they go to visit the guy who wants to being the third victim, and then they feel bad about not telling him. That feels kind of real, because maybe you'd rather get a sandwich that afternoon.
And the way that they, oh man, it's so funny when they're talking, and he's like, it's like three guys put poems in their personal ads. She's like, two of them are dead. And then he goes, oh shit, we should look up that third guy.
Can I also say too that, and we mentioned
that's
this a little
great
bit earlier
cut too.
It's a great cut
when Pacino meets Goodman, right? And Goodman talks about how there's a, you know, one of the killings was in his district, and Goodman's like, we should work together on this. That's something I feel like I've never seen before in a genuine way, because usually it's a competitive thing and it's a conflict thing, and people use it as plot rather than the fact that I'm sure cops do.
Which that. I don't believe. I don't.
You know what I mean?
I don't believe that they're competing. I don't.
Right. Exactly.
I don't believe that. They're.
I mean, if we know anything about cops, it's that they close ranks pretty fast.
I think you know what. I don't believe that. I just believe that they. I believe they clock in, they clock out, they try to get their job done, and that's it. And I don't think there's any like backstabbing. I'm gonna fucking solve this murder before you. Shit. That just seems like, first of all, that seems like something that's invented for TV and movies. It also is way too fucking exhausting. Like, come on.
It's interesting because it makes me think about this movie. I just watched the pilot of Mayor of Easton, the HBO thing with Kate Winslet, which I don't know if either of you have checked out.
I have not had a chance yet.
It's quite good. It has a very Dennis Lehane vibe, which this does too, right? Like, there is that sort of, you know, people acting like you think they hopefully do act to some degree or another within this universe. But that moment of Goodman and Pacino, of Goodman offering up like, hey, man, like, I've got this thing. Maybe it's connected to your thing. Like, we should work together on this. And then they do, and they become friends, and they fucking work on this together. Felt fresh. Like, it shouldn't. But that felt like something believable and interesting, and added a whole element to this, which I really
like. And that's this entire movie is, erotic thrillers are all the rage. How do we do one that goes the other direction from what all of them are? How do we confound expectations? How do we do something fresh? And again, that's why the ending feels disappointing, because the rest of the movie, I think very effectively does something fresh and interesting.
Well, I even, you know, you guys mentioned it a little bit earlier, but like the Richard Jenkins component, which is that Pacino works with Jenkins. Jenkins essentially cuckolded him and stole his wife, who we never meet. But like that first scene that he has with Jenkins when they're at the crime scene together, and Jenkins is like, it's just it's this weird jockeying that's going on.
Pacino keeps like apologizing, but then being like, but also fuck you.
And then later, literally gets into a drunken fight with him after that cop party. And Jenkins, which towers over Pacino, and Pacino's just like this little jackrabbit that's like trying
to... He's kind of messing him up. And
it's great.
Speaking of, we have not mentioned...
We didn't talk about the karate fight. He fights the other... it looks like the only Asian cop. And they just decide to, you know, circle up and have a karate expedition.
It's fucking, why did that happen? What's happening?
And then, and then Goodman's like, oh, that's like watching a movie. And Pacino's just like, well, I got to exercise somehow. Like, what?
it's a good karate fight, too.
Yeah, it's so bizarre.
Oh, God. The 80s were awesome.
Speaking of that cop party, I was watching this with my roommates. My roommate, Beth, was like, I want to find out who the second AD was. Because there are so many scenes with 200 extras in this movie.
Yeah.
Which you would never... That's another thing. I'm sure I've talked to both of you guys about this. That's one of those other things that we didn't know how good we had it. Movies where a scene of simple information, the note you get endlessly now is, well, one, can you cut out anything that's not essential? But also, like, can we take this, when they discover this, can we just take that out, put it in this other scene? We need to save money. We can't have this many locations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This movie has the opening thing. The thing that introduces Pacino as a cop is an elaborate scene in a location we never see again with all of this production design and 100 extras. Yep. You got that cop party with 200 extras, another location, all this activity.
The wedding.
The only thing at the wedding is Pacino coming up with the idea to do the personal ads, an idea he could have had literally
anywhere.
At the cop station where they already have several other scenes.
Everything about that is awesome, character
and world building, and it's the movies. It's why you go to the movies.
Yeah.
Clay, I had the exact same thought. It's why I picked the wedding in the beginning. I had the exact same thought of, I can't believe they staged this entire wedding when nothing happened here. Like, that's an expensive fucking scene. There's a lot of shit that goes into putting together. They got a band. A singer with a wig. And just to have the two guys sit at a table and come up with that idea, I adore that shit.
It's so funny because last night I was watching an episode of something. I can't even remember what it was. And I turned to my roommate and I was like, man, everything is close-ups. It's all fucking out of focus shit in the background. You can never fucking tell. There's no wide shots. It doesn't, because they can't afford it and they don't want to show, you know, whatever. And to your point, Kenny, big old wide shot of that wedding that shows that you've got a couple hundred people there, and that it's, you know, again, Backdraft is another one where it's like there's lots of big wide shots, expensive shots of huge amounts of people. Yeah, I mean, it's, but again, to your point, it goes so far towards world building and putting you in there and making you really feel that this world is lived in. But
and all the street stuff in New York, the restaurant, you could have cheaped out on all of the restaurant stuff so easily, and instead they pick a restaurant that is in front of Lincoln Center.
Yeah,
they have to shut down these streets in front of Lincoln Center. They've got all of these establishing shots with it Lincoln Center framed up. They had to light all of that. It's just like,
it's crazy, man. It's crazy, man. It's good stuff. So as you guys mentioned, go to the wedding. He comes up with the Lonely Hearts ad. They track down this other guy, Raymond Brown, that had an ad. He turns up dead. And then Frank has dinner with several women, posing as a waiter, puts their glasses into evidence bags, that whole thing, meets Alan Barkin. Frank bumps into her again at a market. So they have kind of a second meet cute. She works in a great
authentic meet cute contrivance where again, another scene like with the woman at the bar that is just like, you are not expecting a scene this heartfelt and character based to come up when they're coming up with the poem, the cops. And it's all these cops going, ah, ha, 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 yeah. With their like dirty
roses
lyrics
are
and
red, violets are blue.
Then they reveal that Pacino's dad is there, sad old drunk widower. So and sad. He says this beautiful poem, and they're like, where did you hear that? Did you write that? And he's like, no, Frank's mother wrote it. That's why I fell in love with her. It's like, fuck. And then later when Ellen Barkin's like, that wasn't written by a man. That was written by a woman. He's like, yeah, my mom wrote it. That's why my dad fell in love with her. It's like, poof, Richard Curtis wishes. Like, oh man. What a bit.
So then we have the sex scene that we were talking about, which has a really interesting power dynamic that exists between them. They start to have a romance. Helen's fingerprints are on a glass, but he wipes down the glass. The relationship becomes strained when she discovers that he's a cop. And then one night he gets drunk and basically gives away that it was a sting. And she obviously is perturbed and upset about that. There's a really wonderful scene where he goes to her place. And I'm curious, Kenny, if this, because I do understand where you're coming from in terms of he goes to her place and they have this really beautiful scene where you really see how down and out he is, like how desperate he is for anyone to care about him in the slightest.
Yeah.
And she's receptive to that. And she goes in the other room to grab some stuff before they leave. And he sees the ads on the refrigerator.
Yeah, that's killed these three guys.
That's the fucking, that's the problem. Because I think if you remove that part of it and you just have Rooker show up, it might not have been as
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It might not have bumped me as much because, to your point, Kenny, it shines such a bright light on she's the killer.
Yeah.
In the hopes that you'll be turned around when Rooker shows up. I don't need the ads. Like I could just have her come in because basically he sees the ads and then she says to him, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't hang out tonight. Like I think I should spend the night in and I should, you know, think about this a little bit more. That's enough for me. That should have been the scene. He doesn't need to see the ads. He can go home and then Rooker can show up and you can still have the Deus Ex Machina of all of
that. That's the thing, Phil. By this part of the movie, the movie has sort of backgrounded the investigation so much in favor of the love story and kind of putting you in Frank's head. He has he's backgrounding the investigation because this is his new focus is this relationship. So then whenever that stuff pops up, it's almost like they forgot they were making a mystery and they're like, ah, shit, put in a clue. I don't know. Yeah. And it does feel very, very on the nose because it feels like they don't really care that much about that part of the movie at that point. It's interesting. again, I never thought it was Ellen Barkin. Although watching last night, my roommates, when they saw that, went to, oh, is Ellen Barkin's mother killing people? It's, they figured I was connected to Barkin, but it was someone like shadowing Barkin and killing men. And they're like, oh, is it the mother that's living with them? It does introduce a dynamic, relationship power, male, female dynamic, where then Pacino is almost as upset about the fact that she was sleeping with men through the newspaper, because he bitches about that later in the movie. Yeah. He's like, I would never do that. He's almost as upset or more upset about that than the idea that jealous. Maybe she's the killer.
Yeah.
Which is also a messy and interesting idea, but maybe one that is a little, like, a little too much, too late. Like, there isn't really room to explore that. And it is a bit on the nose. I wish they would have made one more mention, because she says, I have an ex-husband, and they imply that it went badly. But if she was like, oh, my ex-husband was dangerous, maybe something a little bit more built up about Rooker. I don't know. I don't know what the fix there is. I don't think it's a clean make her the killer fix. I don't know if that would work.
No. I don't think that's what it should be, actually. Yeah. I mean, I've very much have been talked off that. But I think it should be this or something like it. I just don't think. I think
it's just too abrupt
a little bit. Yeah. I think this is kind of what Ebert was saying, but I think it insults the audience a little bit.
I agree.
To lay it on so thick, because it goes beyond just the ads. Like, there are, she owns CF Love, which is not, you know, in 1989, it's not everyone is just has a 45 of CF Love hanging around. Yeah. It's too much.
And the music, whenever he discovers something like that, is like, dum, 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 like, it's very over the top. Yeah.
But like, it's, I'm so over it. I'm so over my like picadillos with this movie. Like, I'm just like focused on all the things that I loved, which is almost all of it.
Yeah. So basically, Rooker shows up. They have a classic mano a mano punch fight. That essentially,
I believe there was a crotch punch at some point.
Punch. Like right out of the gate, Pacino's like, "I'm going to get the upper hand.
I'm going to go for the crotch."
And then payoff of the sharpshooter trophy.
Yeah,
remember he pulls it out and whacks him in the head.
I love the idea that you're in a fight with a murderer who's trying to kill you, that you're supposed to keep it clean. Right for the balls.
Go right for the crotch. But then, speaking of interesting dynamics and power dynamics and just images in this movie that are kind of bold for Pacino. I mean, the first scene with Barkin where she backs him up against the wall is fantastic. This, at the end of this, Rooker like going in full psycho mode, gets Pacino on the bed and is like on his ass, like going like humping up and down, going like, is this what it's like? And like this is quite something for 1989 for Pacino, for like a position for Pacino to allow him to be seen that way is very
also at one point, if I'm not mistaken, just jumps on Rooker's back and just, he's a small
like a little
man,
guy. He's a little guy.
A little guy on a big guy that makes him look just, it doesn't make him look.
I like Pacino owning his little guy-ness quite a bit. Pacino's never been my guy, right? De Niro is my guy and Pacino's not my guy. And I've always kind of, I love old Pacino. I love 70s Pacino.
Sure, sure.
But I've always kind of felt like I'm not really on board with the woo-ha Pacino thing, even as a joke. Like, it's just, it's not my thing. I think this is a necessary bridge for people to go from 70s and I guess early 80s Pacino, when I think it falls apart with Scarface. I think everything's just, I think he short circuits in that movie. A De Palma movie I do not like.
Fair.
And this is a necessary bridge to get you from old Pacino to new Pacino. And I like Al Pacino so much more after seeing this movie.
And he's good in this movie. We have definitely talked up the Wet Ass Hour, but... That's so funny because it is a little bit, it is out of character. Like, this is actually a pretty understated grounded performance for the most part.
I agree. So there's two more scenes I want to talk about very quickly. The first is Frank meets up with John Goodman at a bar. Several weeks later, he's sober. John Goodman weirdly taunts him with booze, which is kind of fucked up, but okay. But Frank has a tremendous line, and it might be my favorite line in the whole movie, where he says, Goodman asks him if he's still seeing Ellen Barkin, and he says, why does anyone see anyone? People are a lot of work. It's a fucking great line.
How I feel, brother.
And in classic sort of Pacino, he says it again, like, people are a lot of work. Like, he really just decides to underline the line, but it's a great line. Yeah. And then at the very end, Frank reunites with Helen and they're walking down the street together. It's clear that, like, this scene was a bit messy to actually film, because she kind of cracks up a couple times and he's kind of on the brink of cracking up. It doesn't seem like they locked off the street, because like a bunch of people recognize Pacino, and at one point Pacino gets like legit bumped into by a person
I love that. Him out. Yeah, that's good.
It's just, it's a messy, great scene that actually really works.
I love that, because he's a little guy.
Yeah,
he's a little guy. Little guys get lost. He like runs into a screen and gets like knocked over.
Yeah.
And he's then like taken out of the smile. Shot
almost. Yeah.
Yeah. The smile on his face when he recovers from that.
Yes. It's what I mean. Yeah.
They're improvising. He's recovering.
Yes.
That scene brings me back in the last moments where I'm a little bit like, this feels like a cop out ending.
Yep.
The sincerity of that scene and everything you described, Phil, where it feels real and messy and in the moment. And Pacino has this very genuine smile on his face when he's basically been downtrodden the entire movie.
Yep.
That is, I feel like that's a good vibe. I want these two crazy kids to work it out.
Well, it's funny. And I think Ellen Barkin has a moment too, where she breaks, she smiles, and then she quickly stops the smile because she feels like she's ruining the take, but it works in the moment because it feels like she's needs to like find her grounding again. It's a really good scene. And I think that without all that messiness and without all that like not locked off scene, I think it would have just been kind of a ho-hum, like cutesy ending. So, and I think that kind of embodies the whole movie in a weird way, right? Like, had it been done cleanly, this movie is just not that interesting.
We talked about the big set pieces that don't happen anymore. Those New York scenes that do feel like they just picked it up when they had a chance.
Yeah.
Obviously wouldn't happen anymore. No one would do that. I mean, short of a $100,000 indie. But it's amazing. It really, like, that Sidney Lumet New York thing.
Yep.
Is just the greatest. It's just, it feeds me.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you then, Kenny. I'm from Minnesota, and I've been to New York a handful of times, but I cannot speak about the city with any sort of basis of knowledge. I take it from what you've said, you're a New York guy, or you spent a lot of time there.
I am a suburban guy. But I am from the suburbs of New York. I'm from Westchester.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of time in New York. Yeah.
Would you say that this is would you consider this a good New York movie? If people wanted to watch a New York movie?
Yes.
Or do you think it's good for what it is?
No. I think it's a great New York movie. I think for a lot of reasons. I think I like movies about blue collar people in New York, because New York is an interesting place for a blue collar person. A lot of the blue collar jobs don't exist in the city. So, as I said, like, it basically takes a certain type of lifestyle to have that kind of job and stay in Manhattan. When I say New York, I really mean Manhattan. But what makes a good New York movie? That's the coolest thing about New York for me. It's everything. It's everything from Working Girl to this to Marathon Man to just, you don't know, like in terms of genre, in terms of feel and tone and the type of people there, it could be anything as long as it takes place within the confines of that city, it's just unlike anywhere else. And I'm a huge fan, bigger fan of LA movies. Like, I love LA movies, but so many LA movies can take place in other cities and other places. Your PI draft were almost all LA movies.
Great draft.
They could have been San Francisco movies. I mean, one of them was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, they could have been San Francisco movies and very little would have changed. Yeah. You can't say that about almost any movie that takes place in New York. It has to be a New York movie. So,
have you done a New York draft?
No, and it's another one of those topics. There's a handful of topics that gonna do, can't wait, rich vein, but are almost so big that we need to brainstorm how to break them up. I think if you just did blanket, even if it was what we call like a mega draft, which is usually our show is we do seven. Sometimes topics have more, 13, 20. Those are mega drafts. Even a 20 mega draft, which is the most we'll ever do in one sitting, and that still runs 5 hours. I don't know if you could do that as a, like, New York is, I don't think you could capture it.
So
I've played with doing decades, maybe.
Right.
80s New York movies, 70s, because as Kenny pointed out with the different mayors, New York is a place that has really definable eras in history. And it looks and feels different given the decade, even regardless of how, you know, film styles have changed. Probably we'll do decades, but I haven't totally figured out how to do New York yet, but I'd love to do New York. I'd love to do LA. Like Kenny, I love an LA movie.
Yeah.
So those are all things that will happen. Just need to figure out the best way to break them up.
The way I might consider going to LA is LA non-entertainment and maybe non-PI. And then I wonder where, not crime, non-entertainment, I wonder where you'd wind up.
Not crime, not That's entertainment would leave maybe four movies, but that would be a fun.
It's LA Story. They all star Steve Martin, Father of the Bride. But but yeah, I do think that those
are the two. Nancy Myers is a fair amount of California. LA
yeah.
Movies, right?
Well, the thing about LA is it's pretty much the default for everything. Right. Like every movie is L.A. unless, you know, someone decides I'm going to make a point of not having it in L.A.
Well, you got Spanglish would be on there.
That's what I do, by the way. I said everything in L.A. unless there's some very specific reason I can't.
Right.
Because I want to shoot in L.A. for one. And two, it's where I live. It's I've lived here for 15 years. I get it. And most writers have. Most directors have. Most actors, et cetera, have. So we get this world. Yeah. In fact, I'm setting something in 80s New York. I have something that's set in 80s New York right now. And I'm nervous about it. I'm nervous that I will not be able to bring to it what I would require as a viewer in another 80s, you know, New York movie.
I hear that. Well, before we get to our John Goodmans, do we want to rate this? And
So
do you have any other thoughts that you want to hit before we move on to?
I might have some straight. I mean, I took notes.
Okay, please.
I might have some stray thoughts.
Please.
Do you guys do a stray thoughts segment?
Absolutely.
We do now.
We're doing it right now.
I like they use Sea of Love like the Jaws theme.
Sea of Love.
Every character actor, I just wrote a note with multiple exclamation points.
Yep.
The woman who shows up with the balloons on her wrists is a fantastic bit. And she's like crying on the couch with the balloons still on her wrist.
Yep, it's great.
Very good, very good.
Very good, very good.
This is all. We covered everything. Oh, the end credits is Sea of Love.
Tom Waits covered
by Tom Waits.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah. Not a guy you'd expect to cover Sea of Love.
No, but it sounds awesome. And yeah, just like once again, come the wet ass hour, I'm everybody's daddy. Kenny, have you ever asked your cousin about the wet ass hour?
I have no doubt that he uses the term wet ass hour.
He's a cop in
New Jersey, and part of his I forget what the county's called, but part of his jurisdiction is Newark. Mm-hmm. So that's even like more hard scrabble than even New York. That's New York without any of the charm. There's not even like a Sbarro's in Newark. So this guy has spent a lot of time in the wet ass hour.
That's incredible.
He's the coolest. That's
amazing.
He's the coolest guy.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Well, I didn't see this in 89, so I can't rate it then. But before this podcast, I came in at this at a 75. But I got to say, this conversation has only made me like the film that much more. I'm up to an 85 now. I think it's you know, I bump on the ending just as much as we all do. It's what it is. But weirdly, it doesn't affect me at all, because I think that the two scenes that come after, which we talked about at the bar and then subsequently in the street with Alan Barkin, make me forget all about that stupid shit where Michael Rooker sort of weirdly threw himself out a window.
You would too if Al Pacino rejected you.
Yeah, I guess. I'm at an 85. What about you, Kenny? I know that you went through more of an emotional journey.
Oh,
on this
I one. Sure did, pal. So I was like, I was excited because we've done so many of these 89 movies where I've just been like 99, like this, just the best, like 90, 98, yeah. Like 97. Like these are like our favorite movies. Like, yeah. So I was kind of excited to have one that wasn't always that I thought was not that great. And the reason I smiled in the beginning was I was excited to like throw bombs and like be clever. And I was like, oh my God, I gave this movie a 54. I'm such a wild
wow.
man.
Wow.
It's not a 54. It's so much higher. I'm going to give it an 82. I so rarely come up. I do occasionally come up quite a bit. Going up 30 points almost is unusual. That's kind of thing has happened on the podcast, but, I really would have liked to have watched this in a theater with other people.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a blast.
I'm really happy we got to talk about it after. This is a great flick. I don't know what I ate yesterday or 2 days ago when I watched this or what got stuck in my craw, but this is 82 might even be low. But
that's great.
Yeah. I think I love this movie now.
What about you, Clay?
Well, okay, so strap in, because I'm going to take you on a roller coaster ride. When I saw this years ago, it was very high, 80, 85, maybe up to 90. I checked my letterbox. I put it at a 4.5 out of 5 stars at some point.
Oh, wow, there you go.
But I think that was bolstered because, again, zero expectations, and then it's something you never really seen before or since. And at that point, I didn't know anybody else had seen it, so it felt kind of like I had it on my pick shelf at
sure.
as a video store employee. I was like, this is a real, at this point, even though apparently it was a huge hit, it felt at that point like an under the radar thing. I got a little sure. bit of, you know, I felt kind of good being like, oh, I got something you've never seen before. Also bolstered a little bit like that. Then I saw it in that situation at the Arrow on 35 with a full house. Al Pacino's there. That's just the perfect way to watch a movie. Yeah. Maintained right at like 90. Then I watched it for this, and I was a little bit more critical of the ending. And I was like, ah, shit, I picked this movie for the thing. I recommended it to Phil and Kenny. Like, this doesn't, you know, this isn't quite as good as I remember. And I dropped a little bit. We're down to like maybe 75 or 80. And then, like all you guys, this conversation brought me back up again. And I just because I want to continue being the person who likes this movie more than anyone else I know, I'm going to go with an 86.
Love it.
All right.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, listen,
DVD art. I sent it to Phil.
Oh my God.
I think
it's horrendous.
I think that's one of the reasons why its reputation evaporated, because the home video art is abysmal.
It's really bad. But I got to say, like, this is just one of those films that I knew of it. I, you know, certainly was probably going to watch it someday. Thrilled to watch it for this. This was great. So let's do our top 7 John Goodman films.
Because we did talk about John Goodman a lot mm-hmm. in our Sea of Love convo, but I think we did undersell just how fucking fun
right.
he is in this movie.
I kind of wanted to hold on to some of this as we work our way around. So I'll start at number 7. I got Barton Fink at number 7. I like Barton Fink. Clay's leaving.
Okay.
I don't, it's not one of my favorite Coens. I know that
I'm so confused by you right now.
Let me hold on.
Is he pulling out a Barton Fink poster? Yeah. I mean, that's cool. Barton Fink's cool. It's on my list.
I'm not confused by you, Clay. I'm confused by you, Phil. You only have so many Coen slots. And he's been in half dozen or more Coens.
Yeah.
And this is one of the ones you picked, and you don't even like it that much?
I do like it. It's just not one of my favorite Coens. The reason that I put it on here is that it this is the thing that I grapple with an actor like John Goodman, right? Which is a John Goodman movie or a movie John Goodman is in. So and my list is sort of, I tried to pick things that I felt he was very prominent in as opposed to just great movies that he happened to be in. I say this, I like Raising Arizona more than Barton Fink, but I don't really consider that a John Goodman film because John Goodman has like only a couple lines in it. So again, that's just me. I made my own rules for this. I'm not saying you guys need to.
No. I think your rules are very fair. And I think we probably both grappled with the same thing. The thing about John Goodman is he's made so few movies that are John Goodman movies.
Well,
almost none where he's number one on the call sheet. So
my list is a smattering of some and some that are not. So, but all that being
said, maybe I haven't seen the ones where he's number one on the call sheet, but I have one and I put it on there pointedly to make the point pointedly.
I think I have a feeling. I don't think that any of my one of them, he's like two on the call sheet.
That's the highest he gets on the call sheet?
I think so.
All right, I have one where he's definitely the star. And okay. I made a point of it. Like,
I understand.
John Goodman has starred in a movie before.
I understand. My number seven is Barton Fink. I think it's a great movie. I think he's fucking great in it. I think it's one of those like towering John Goodman, the Coen brothers just making a giant in the frame, sweaty, and just this behemoth of a person.
Good fire movie, Clay.
Good fire
movie.
It is a good fire movie.
That's
true.
But that's my number seven. What about you, Kenny?
My number seven is Flight.
Sure.
A movie I like quite a bit, more than most people. Yeah. And John Goodman is a total wild man in it. And I love
it. Oh,
His
introduction in that movie is
to Sympathy from the Devil.
Yeah.
All-timer. Fucking wild. I think he's a great counterbalance to sad sack, fucking around, drunk Denzel.
Mm-hmm.
He's a weird choice for this movie. And in terms of like when you cast John Goodman, you made a choice. Zemeckis made a choice here, particularly for this role, which couldn't have possibly been written for him. So I do like the movie quite a bit. And I like Goodman's performance in it, showing how wild he can get.
Him and Denzel are partners in Fallen, right? Together? Is that?
They are in Fallen together. Yeah.
Oh, Fallen was one I wanted to like more.
Yes, that's right. Well, okay, Clay, what's your seven?
Okay, so Flight is not on my list, although I do like him in that movie. My looking at his filmography was weird for me for all the reasons you guys said. He's not the star of that many movies, but he does have very memorable supporting roles in a lot of movies.
He does.
But also, I have not seen a couple of his big movies. I have not seen Matinee. I have not seen King Ralph.
Okay.
So neither of those are on my list because I have not seen them, even though those are two, like, he is the guy on the poster.
Yeah.
Movies. My number seven is Arachnophobia.
Good movie.
Which is, he's got a relatively small part in, but it is easily the most memorable role in the film.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few movies where he is a full-blown goofy cartoon, aside from the movie where he played a literal cartoon character. Yeah. But this one, like, I forget what his character is. He's got it's something like Gus or Rufus or something, and he's got his goggles, and he's doing like a weird voice, and he's got...
Yep.
He belongs
in Men in Black in that movie.
It's a Men in Black character, yeah. And but it's the best part of the movie, in a movie that I like. Mm-hmm. He's easily the best part and very memorable. Arachnophobia is my number seven.
Arachnophobia to me also falls in with Backdraft, the movie Clay has said he recently watched, and that was a huge movie when it came out. That was a movie that everybody on the playground was talking about. Did you see Arachnophobia? And it's a movie that's kind of been lost to time a little bit.
I agree.
I think that, Clay, is a good movie to suggest to Ryan to play at the...
For the Arrow, yeah.
Arrow.
Good, and it's funny. It's funny. It's high energy. Yeah. It's scary. It's a good
and it's
crowd
not,
movie.
It's not...
Delbert is his character name.
Of course it is.
It's unusual in that it kind of is something that that Tim Burton might have made, but is not like a Tim Burton movie at all.
Yep.
No.
Yep.
You know, and I like that about it. Or like, you know, a Joe Dante movie, but it's not like a Joe Dante movie either, but it's not so serious that it's, you know, exhausting. It's a fun, weird, horrible movie.
Yeah. not Jeff Bridges. The dad is Daniels. Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels. Yeah.
Frank Marshall did a good job with that movie.
He did do a good job with that movie. My number six is Sea of Love. We've talked about it. It's a great movie.
I didn't even consider it. Honorable mention, Sea of Love.
What's your six, Kenny?
My six is a movie where John Goodman is the lead of the movie. King Ralph! What a flick!
Yeah,
Clay, I implore you to watch it.
I absolutely will, yeah.
It has.
I'm sure it's going to be a Hosley pick on Blank Check sometime.
It has
very soon,
the best
about it.
Yes, I think they have.
Yeah.
It has the best fucking premise imaginable.
It's so
And it is, yes, it is a movie that I one day will emulate one way or another. I love the idea of some slob rising up way above his station and having all this immense, absurd power. And he's Goodman all the way. That's interesting because it almost is a study in what it would be like if Goodman, or what it was like, I think, if Goodman played a John Candy role. Because that's way more of a John Candy role. And he kills it. He's awesome. So, Ralph, the king.
What's your six, Clay?
My six, and again, I don't. Well, my list is going to be weird, maybe. John Goodman is one of the great voice actors.
That's true.
And a movie that I think I have two animated movies on.
I mean,
my
I have
list.
One for sure.
Yeah. I've got two. I think we probably have one of the same ones. But at number six, a movie that I think is again. Viewed differently by people in different micro generations because it really came at a weird time. But I think one of the funniest animated movies ever made, The Emperor's New Groove.
That's right. He's in that. I forgot he was in that.
He is Pacha. It's him and David Spade. David Spade's best thing he ever did is playing.
You haven't seen Lost and Found, I guess.
In this.
Yeah. I mean,
that's true.
The 99 classic.
Incredible voice performance. Again, he always gives so much humanity and authenticity to these characters and just plays a sweet man, a great straight man role to David Spade's goofy character. Mm-hmm. And I like also that the character is designed, he kind of looks, he's John Goodman proportions. So uh-huh. he is able to bring that full, as Kenny described him, this like hug of a man energy to this character. And the great thing about Emperor's New Groove is not just that it's hilarious, and it is hilarious. Mm-hmm. It has genuine earned heart, and Goodman's performance is a big part of that. And it's hard to do that with just your voice via a cartoon. And he does it better than most.
I have never seen The Emperor's New Groove, so I need to watch it. But
yeah. And I have never seen it either. And it had this, did it just hit a 20th anniversary? Maybe?
I believe so.
It was 2000 or 2001, yeah.
So, because very recently it kind of, you know, cropped up again on Twitter and on all the, the corporate blogs I read. I kept trying to get my kids to watch it. And my son, who is 9, will only watch R-rated movies now unless I force him. And daughter, who is also 9 because they are twins, claims she's seen it and then It's not even a claim. She rattled off the whole plot to me. And I'm like, I guess you saw it, but like, how is that possible? Because I'm the only one who shows you movies. So I will watch it with my 3-year-old Cole when he's ready for
Perfect.
It.
Perfect. Well, and it is a bright, colorful, kooky. I think a little kid could enjoy it, even if the joke writing is very in sort of a Muppets way. Like the jokes are for adults. They're very smart. And John Goodman, not even the most notable, Patrick Warburton in this movie is one of the great comedic performances of all time.
I gotta watch it.
High recommendation from me.
My number five is a movie that was much maligned at the time, and I would say by me as well, until I listened to the Blank Check episode on it and was completely turned around on it. But
Jupiter!
Speed Racer, number 5. I think that John Goodman absolutely understands what movie he's in, and is bringing just I mean, first of all, he kind of looks like the character that he actually is emulating from the anime series. But he's just, he's really bringing it. It's a very big, bolsterous, crazy role in a crazy movie. And I really love him in it. I think that movie is kind of a masterpiece. I'm not going to lie.
I need to see it again. I remember the opening being one of the most exhilarating, brilliant insane. Openings of all time. That like all of the exposition, everything interwoven with that mm-hmm. crazy race. And I was like, this is brilliant visual storytelling. And then I remember the rest of the movie being a bit not my speed, but I would never besmirch. I saw it
on the big screen when it came out, and I truthfully think I was just exhausted by it. It's a really aggressive visual movie, and I just don't think that I really was able to process what was being put in front of me. And subsequently, I'd love to see it again on the big screen. But Kenny, what's your five?
Okay.
You had Speed Racer.
Nothing. I have no thoughts on Speed Racer except that I considered it and didn't do it. But my five is Barton Fink. Because Barton Fink's an amazing film, and John Goodman's amazing in it as one of my two Coens. I considered Llewyn Davis, but I think that's the one I crossed out when we decided to have a informal two Coen limit. But I really love Barton Fink. It's an awesome Hollywood movie.
It's a great movie. What's your five, Clay?
Sea of Love is my five.
My four. Is another 1999 movie, or not another, a 1999 movie, Bringing Out the Dead.
Mine too, Phil.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, all right. Look at us. We always agree.
I think he's great. I think that, you know, he plays of the three partners that Nick Cage has in that film, he plays sort of the most sort of subdued, I would say. It gets increasingly more manic as it progresses. But he's kind of, there's something very sort of, it's one of the more kind of sad John Goodman roles. Like he's kind of resigned himself in a lot of ways, and he just wants to get the fuck out of this racket. And there's just a very, like, there's a, I don't know, there's a weight to Goodman in the movie that I really appreciate. But
are we all going to have the same top three?
We might.
I think we will. Oh. Well, you're not. Yeah, I assume Clay's going to have Barton Fink in the top three. I saw the poster.
Yeah.
But all right, keep going. I wonder what you're not going to have.
So we both did Bring Out the Dead for four, right? So
we have a whole episode on it. Listen to it.
Yeah. What's your four, Clay?
My four. I love Bringing Out the Dead. It's been a long time since I saw it, so I didn't remember it well enough or how big his part was. It sounds like it should be high on my revisit list, because I do remember thinking it was excellent.
It's great.
Amazing. Four. Oh, my four is my second animated pick, movie that I was shocked and dismayed did not do better on
your
the
Pixar
screen
draft.
Pixar draft. That for Kenny, my money.
I got more texts from Kenny about that Monsters, Inc. pick.
So angry.
He was so angry.
A movie that has somehow become underappreciated, even though it is top three Pixar for me. Monsters, Inc. is my number four.
Monsters, Inc. is great. And I think it's, you mentioned it earlier when you were talking about Emperor's New Groove, but like if John Goodman was an animated character, it is Sully. Like he is, it personifies everything that you believe about John Goodman.
Yeah.
I want to make a point about that.
Yeah.
If John Goodman is an animated character, he is Sully, because Sully is the aura of John Goodman.
Yeah.
But Sully is not an overweight character.
Correct.
Which is really interesting to me that Pixar and the guys who, I think that was a Pete Docter film, or maybe Andrew Stanton, can't remember. One of the two dudes.
I think that was the first Doctor.
Stanton?
I think it's Doctor.
I think it's the first Doctor,
Whoever it was picked up that the essence of Goodman is a big, warm, cuddly, blue, very, very efficient and very confident and very trustworthy and morally unambiguous monster. and I love that.
He has the most trustworthy voice you could ever possibly imagine.
Yes. Sully. It's higher on my list. I assume it's higher on yours, Kenny. But
it is.
My number three is 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh, then we don't have the same top three because you put 10 Cloverfield Lane on yours.
Phil, no, that is also my three.
Oh, there you go.
Wow, guys. Wow, bros.
I think that movie is underrated. It kind of had a splash sort of moment when it came out in the sense that people were like, huh, this movie's better than people expected it to be. I don't think people knew what to make of sort of the connection to the Cloverfield film. They had subsequently kind of pissed away any goodwill people have towards this potential franchise, but
pop quiz. Do either of you remember the title of the post Super Bowl Netflix drop Cloverfield film?
The Cloverfield Paradox?
You guys both knew it. Okay, well, there you go. Not as good of a pop quiz as I assumed.
Well, what's annoying, I'm never going to get over.
My point was that movie was forgotten instantly, but apparently
it wasn't
not
originally called that. It was called something particle. The God particle. It wasn't even a fucking Cloverfield.
I'm never going to get over how horribly we did on the trivia for the Bruckheimer Jeff because we're good at trivia. Yeah, we know our fucking shit. And like, those questions were absurd.
Those questions were hard, man. Anyway.
Yeah.
But 10 Cloverfield Lane is one of those movies that I actually just recently rewatched. It's, you know, Dan Trachtenberg did a phenomenal job. It's a great looking movie. It's got a great vibe. And John Goodman playing against type in a way that felt believable and foreboding. And he's obviously a very large man. So like there is a physical presence to him that's very sort of unsettling in the film. But at the same time, you do feel that fatherly vibe. Like there's a lot wrestling inside John Goodman's performance in that movie. So that's my
point. And it was casting that I don't know if anybody else could do that. I mean, everything you said, Phil, I think the movie's great. You need a guy who everybody instinctually likes and trusts because this guy is supposed to be scary, but then, is he maybe telling the
truth? Don't give too much away.
He has to vacillate.
He's never seen it. So
Kenny hasn't seen it. This character has to vacillate, and the audience has to kind of switch sides a few times. And I think you need John Goodman for that, and he shows the range of being able to do that.
Kenny, I think you would really like 10 Cloverfield.
I'd like to see it. I thought Cloverfield proper was not good.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with Cloverfield.
Yeah, no, I know. But it kind
stylistically, narratively, it has nothing to do with it.
It's one of those things where it kind of just soured me on the vision, right? The what they were doing, because I'm a big fan of the notion of a very loosely interconnected world, right? The purge of it, right?
Yep.
I'm crazy about the purge
American horror story.
Yeah, man.
The purge is awesome, and they've really taken it like about as far as I would have dream they could take it, right? Because there's the idea, yes, if this happens in the whole country, there's so many incredibly interesting stories that can go down.
I have
down.
Like four dozen ideas for Purge movies.
Yeah, I mean that, and that's what's so cool about it, right?
Yeah.
So I like that concept with the Cloverfield world, right? If I'm not mistaken, it's just something that is happening while there's also a monster attack happening.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. And maybe I will watch it because I
think you really like it.
But I thought, Cloverfield, very hat on a hattie with the
I get that.
The found footage and the monster attack. I think it forced a lot of things that irked me.
One of the few movies to physically make me ill in the theater that I had to stop looking at the screen. The original Cloverfield. I was just like, I'm going to puke. Anyway,
what's
your three, Kenny?
My three is a movie I guess none of you guys have. Maybe you do, Clay, even though I know one of your top two. Argo. Do we not like Argo in this room?
Argo was actually on my list.
Mr. HM?
Sea of Love punted it from eight.
I think Argo is a great film. I love Argo. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. There's been going around on Twitter that pick three best picture winners of the last, I guess it was since 1980.
Yep.
And everybody rightfully has Amadeus because that's probably,
pick Amadeus.
And Silence of the Lambs.
I picked Silence.
Because those are, you know, two actual masterpieces that won best picture. And then after that, it is a bit of a, what do you do next? Right. Because I mean, people have their favorites. People have movies they like that won Best Picture, but I'm not sure there's another movie that won Best Picture in the last 40 years. That's really a unquestioned masterpiece. The way I think those two are kind of, maybe Amadeus isn't, I think it kind of,
I'm on board with Amadeus, but I would also say Titanic and Parasite
and No Country.
No Country is.
No Country was your other choice. Parasite would have been my third. No Country is a great movie too. I love that movie. And Titanic also, you know, you're a jerk if you don't love Titanic. But I did notice, you know, you look at all these movies and they do feel like a lot of movies that suffered by winning Best Picture. The classic example of, you know, the counterfactual is La La Land. How if La La Land won Best Picture, I think it would be the most fucking detested movie of all time now.
But La La Land dodged a bullet by losing Best
Picture.
Huge
bullet. Now La La Land is like a nice flick. It's like a nice flick that people like are kind of okay with.
Yeah.
But if it won Best Picture, it would be crash level, right? Yeah. So I think Argo is a nice flick, good flick that God knows how someone decided this is the year we're going to give Best Picture to a good flick. Yeah. And I think it suffered significantly because of that. Like, people think it's like not even one of Ben Affleck's best movies, but it is. It's a really, really great movie. I think part of it is also the
Chris Terrio factor of like, that was ultimately, like, sorry.
I wouldn't know. Tell me. I don't know.
Well, he wrote Argo. It was essentially one of his first produced movies, if not his first produced. Well,
he wrote The Town too.
Right. But the Town, did he?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe he did. So, long story short, he wins the Oscar for Argo, and then he basically makes two of the most despised franchise installments in Batman versus Superman and in Rise of Skywalker. And I think that perhaps the sour taste people have towards Chris Terrio has kind of bled over into Argo.
I was
unfairly
down. Sorry, my bad.
Okay, but but ultimately, I don't think that. And Chris Terrio has tried to do what he can without burning bridges by trying to be like, the first draft that I wrote, I thought was pretty good, but what was turned into these fucking movies is not. So like, it is what it is. But I do think that part of that has perhaps had us put a stink on Argo a little bit, which is unfair.
I guess. I don't know.
I haven't seen it since it came out. I remember liking it fine in the theater. And John Goodman has a really fun part. He's great in the movie.
Yeah, with Alan Arkin.
I've never revisited
great.
It, but I don't have any ill feelings towards Arkin.
You also don't have like a big need to revisit it. You saw the movie. You know what it's about. It does kind of stick in your head. It's a very specific movie in all the best ways. It's fun. It's capery. Yeah. Great performances throughout. And winning Best Picture was just a fucking weird little thing that happened to this like good movie.
It's probably the best fake film production as a cover for something else going on movie.
I have two quick things I want to say about Argo. The first is, had Argo been directed by Clooney, because he only produced it,
yeah, it would have been the worst.
Would it have been a bad movie?
Of course it would have been. By our worst living film director? Yes, it would have been terrible.
So, Kenny, I take it Suburbicon would not show up in your Suburbia draft.
I don't think so. You know, but I have like, you know, Ben Affleck is my Monica Potter. So, and
me a Ben Affleck draft.
Affleck versus Damon.
I would 100%
mega, mega,
sign up
so
that.
40 flicks. But Affleck is my pot. Like, there was a right around the time of Argo, you know, the Gone Baby Gone Town Argo thing. I went hard on like the Ben Affleck redemption story is the greatest story ever told.
And then.
Back Tattoo, Jennifer Garner, Dunkin' Donuts. You know, it's he's a tough one, but like I have such an enormous place in my heart for him. Where like the way back comes out and is basically Good Ben movie. Affleck being like, all right, this is me today. And it's just, I'm like, yeah, Ben, I appreciate you putting that all out there. Yeah. So, can I just say that
the image, and Lord knows who got this photo of him, but the photo of him at dusk with the towel, overweight, and the back tattoo just looking out at the ocean is the most Ben Affleck photo that's ever been.
Oh, no. It's the Dunkin' Donuts outside the gates of his mansion.
Yeah,
it's
Phil, if the photo doesn't have Dunkin' in it, it's not the most iconic Ben Affleck photo.
It's that deep sigh. It's that... Here we go again. And I know that Saturday morning feeling. You come in, you got your Dunkin' Donuts, you're hoping that buys you like 45 minutes of calm with your 40 kids. But it's just
Have we figured out which Dunkin' he goes to every single day?
Is there one in Malibu? Because it's probably that one. I don't know. Anyway, so
Who's up?
Did we all do our threes?
Yeah, you guys.
My
both
three was also 10 Cloverfield Lane. Yeah,
my two's Monsters, Inc.
As is mine.
It's the best. It's John Goodman. It's one of, and I think our number ones are probably the same. But what's your number two?
Well, I want to say one thing about Monsters, sure. Inc. Monsters, Inc. is probably the most emotional I've ever been in a film. Maybe Toy Story 3, but Monsters, Inc. was the end of Monsters, Inc. affected me like maybe no other first watch I can remember. Yeah. Toy Story 3 was a little different because I was just kind of blubbering throughout that movie. But the end of Monsters, Inc. really affected me, and I was very, very angry about your Pixar draft.
The thing about the end of Monsters, Inc., it's that it does two things which ultimately are Pixar, you know, in its DNA. The first is a absolutely breathtaking visual feast of the door sequence, of the chase through the doors, which is just
how has that not become a ride? How is that possible?
It's unbelievable.
It defies reason.
And then saying goodbye to Boo is just like, it's emotionally devastating. what's your number two, Clay?
When are they going to do a Boo movie where she's an adult and it's like a fucking Hook thing where she's like, she thinks that Mike and Sully are like figments from her imagination as a kid. And then it's about her and her kid and Mike and Sully.
I want to see that live action.
Yeah. Why is that not
live action? Cool.
The first Pixar live action animated. Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's a crossover. You know, that's like the off-speculated Vivica A. Fox's daughter.
Kill Bill 3.
Yeah. Where she actually goes back to get Uma, which, you know, I think we're getting close to. That girl's probably in her early 20s.
I mean, Boo would be now 20. She'd be 23, 24, if you just keep it consistent with
Boo.
There's no reason to keep it consistent with the real-world timeline. But
I would do it fucking live action. I think that'd be so weird and so much fun. Mm-hmm.
So you're number two, Clay.
Been going back and forth on this.
I can only assume that you're vacillating between the two movies I think you are.
I'm sure I am. I mean, it's not fun if we all have the same number one, but I do think in some ways...
Listen to your heart.
Okay, fine. At number two, I will put Barton Fink.
There it is.
Barton Fink... depending on the day, is my favorite Coen Brothers movie. That and Fargo go back and forth. I think Barton Fink is absolute masterwork. And John Goodman, he was nominated for
He should have been nominated.
It is the greatest injustice in the history of the Oscars. Yes. That is a Best Supporting Actor trophy if I've ever fucking seen one. Yeah, he's a force of nature, a singular character, but he has played singular characters in every Coen Brothers movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that the one that's going to be our number one is just a bigger part. It almost feels like a co-lead at times.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that movie and get to it. I think Barton Fink is a little bit undersung because it's a tough movie. It is a darker, weirder, more... distant movie. It's a little bit more ambiguous and a little bit more not of this universe.
Yeah.
And I think it is a little bit more inscrutable, which is what I love about it. Every time I watch it, I try to figure it out, and I find that engaging.
Yeah.
And also just all the Hollywood stuff is Michael Lerman. Michael Lerman. He won for this. Michael Lerner won.
Did not win, but was nominated.
He was nominated. Yeah.
So he was nominated.
That's not even my favorite. He was nominated for this. Yes.
He was nominated. Very deserved. Polito is so funny in this movie. Yeah. Monk Shalhoub is incredible in this movie.
Mm-hmm. He's also taken interest.
Great stuff. Great movie. Goodman's great. Turturro's great. They're all great. I'm forgetting Frasier's dad.
John Mahoney.
Great. They're all great.
I think part of the reason that this film.
Wasn't Mahoney in the movie we just saw?
It was Spencer.
Spencer, yes.
They're easy to flip.
Yeah. I think part of the reason that this film isn't one of my favorites is because, anyone who knows the Coens know that they were writing Miller's Crossing. They had writer's block. They couldn't figure out how to end the movie. So they wrote a movie about writer's block, essentially. And as a writer, watching this film just fills me with the dread that you have when you're sitting in front of a computer and you don't know. It's a horror movie for writers. And I understand that that's why people love it, but it's also why it has never fully got in my veins in that way.
If you have a gut reaction to something, that's the best thing to go off of, I think, you know? I love Miller's Crossing. And when you said Michael Lerner, I was thinking John Polito. And John Polito is so fucking good in everything he does. He's my favorite.
Oh, he's good. And he's good in the movie we're going to talk about at number one.
Yeah,
one movie.
I mean, it's Big Lebowski is number one.
I have The Babe.
If you did, that'd be incredible.
Yes, Big Lebowski, number one. Yes,
Big Lebowski.
You know, The Big Lebowski is... obviously, it's a masterpiece, and we all of us love it. The thing about Goodman in this movie is that, at least for me, is how fucking aggravating he is in this film, which is not a thing I generally associate with John.
Right.
He is just infuriating.
He's so aggro. He's the most aggro fucking character.
But also, you know that he's just got a giant heart as well. Like all of this is like, he loves the dude so much that his frustrations are in the fact that like the dude's unhappy or whatever the case might be. The dude doesn't love himself. He doesn't. Exactly. There's also something about him being a Jewish convert as well that I love. How passionate he is about Judaism. It's just tremendous.
The most passionate Jews are converts.
Yes. Very, very
people true. people who actually buy into our bullshit.
Yes. I think there's also just we only see Goodman bowl once, I believe, in The Big Lebowski, and it's after like the shit has hit the fan, and the way he's holding the ball and just standing there smoking, and he personifies everything I love and I guess sort of hate about John Goodman. I don't know, it's wonderful. Anyway,
I am scared. I think that's all right. So love and sort of hate. I don't think you hate John Goodman, but I think what you're getting at is this could go real wrong.
Like a
guy who has these traits could be the most just detestable human being.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And he's not. He uses his power for good, and that's wonderful about him.
Yeah.
John Goodman can make you find the lovable humanity in any character. No, and I like this. And partially, it's because of the costuming and stuff. But this does not feel like a John Goodman-y character. This is like a Nick Nolte character or something. And John Goodman brings, as Phil said, that dynamism to it.
Yeah, Nick Nolte character. Yeah.
Walter Sobchak is just one of the great film characters. Instantly iconic. Every line is great. It's just, and it is a bigger role than his part in Barton Fink. Yeah. So that's why I ended up going with agreeing with you guys and putting Lebowski up on.
I don't know that there's another actor that I could think of that could pick up a paralyzed person and drop them on the ground, and I'd be kind of okay with it. Like,
yes. I mean, that's the movie, though. That's there's a lot, you know, the tone of that movie's doing a lot of work there
for sure. But it's just like, if Nick Nolte did it, you'd be like, this guy's a fucking monster.
You know what pisses me off about Big Lebowski?
How great this is.
How what?
How great it is.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Yeah. What pisses me off about Big Lebowski is it came out basically in like the only window in American history where it would not have been appreciated.
Correct.
So everybody, and I saw Fargo in the theaters with my dad. It was immediately his favorite movie. I've never seen him react like that. He's like, that is a masterpiece. Fargo has since basically become my favorite movie. We went and saw Big Lebowski together expecting something like Fargo.
Yeah.
And it couldn't be more different. And it was very jolting for all of these people who had just come to the Coens through Fargo. Because Fargo was, there were other Coen movies, Raising Arizona, you know, chief among them, that had a cultural imprint, but nothing was like Fargo.
Correct.
Right? And so Fargo happened, blew everybody to fucking bits, and you just expected, and this is another fucking crime caper with, you know, incapable criminals too. Yeah. So you think it's going to be similar, and it's nothing like that. And it wasn't enjoyed. It wasn't even that well reviewed at the time. It wasn't that the viewings were not raucous, and there was no kind of communal feeling that you get from it now. But if this movie, the other time this happened for them was Burn After Reading, which is a fucking much worse movie, but also a movie that really suffered from coming out after, you know, big Oscar movie, right? Yeah. So any other time, if we had been a little more primed for this movie from the Coens, if we had been, and again, not their fault that their first eight movies kind of flew under the radar, but if we had been a little more primed for this,
and it
came out, people understood that like the Coens contained multitudes, I think that this would have had a much different 1990, I think it came out in 98, a much different 1998 than it wound up having, which is kind of like, in the moment, people pretend this isn't the case, but it's the case, it was a blip.
Well, I would say that the other film that had a similar situation, not obviously as much of a cult following, but Hudsucker has a similar feeling too, right? Which is they had the wind at their back a little bit. They had made Miller's Crossing. They had made Barton Fink. People were like, they're ready for the big time. Warner Brothers, and of all people, Joel Silver, gives them a shit ton of money to make this pastiche 30s weird, quirky comedy. And the thing just lands with a fucking thud. And ultimately, you know, Fargo turns it around for them, but it takes years, and it's like PolyGram and a bunch of independent in order to get Fargo to even happen. And then obviously, you know, the rest is history. But I agree with you, Kenny. Like, I saw The Big Lebowski in the theater with a buddy, and I, even having seen some Coen Brothers films before this, was also flummoxed by the film. Like, I specifically remember the moment in The Big Lebowski when the dude pulls out the kid's homework from the crease between the car seat, and he's like looking at it, and he's perplexed, and there's like all these grammatical errors. And I remember thinking to myself, I also have no fucking idea what's going on right now. Like, it really is just, but that's what's wonderful about it.
I came to it from a totally different place, which is I was
Minnesota.
I was 10. I was in Minnesota. I was 10 when it was in theaters, so I was not seeing it in theaters. Yeah. But by the time I saw it in high school in 2003, 2004, it had become a cult movie. That was a DVD release.
Beyond cult.
In by 2003, this was
an institution.
Institution. Yes. And I had been heard about it for years. It's like, oh, finally time to see The Big Lebowski, the movie everybody says
is brilliant.
Outside of Office Space is the funniest movie ever made. And I watched it with that, and I was like, I kind of like it. I don't know. I'm not sure. But like with every Coen Brothers movie, you need to watch it twice. You need to watch it three times. Now, in the course of my life, I've seen it maybe four times, and every time I watch it, it scoots up my Coen ranking. It really is just a
it's tremendous.
All right. So before we end this podcast, because we can do whatever we want on this podcast, it's our podcast. what is the funniest movie you've ever seen in theaters?
Oh boy.
Hot Rod.
I think Hot Rod. Okay.
Hot Rod. That, the hardest I've laughed and the audience was laughing was the first time I saw Hot Rod. I was sliding out of my chair laughing.
That's a great answer.
It's a great answer.
Like having to I've said this before, having to intentionally stop laughing because I could feel myself getting lightheaded. Like, okay, you have to stop laughing or you're going to pass out having that thought.
Guys, I'm going to have to pause for one quick second. There's a really big spider that just appeared.
Arachnophobia!
That I need to kill. Hold on.
Yes.
Hold on. Yeah, keep the camera on.
Phil comes back into the room in full Delbert gear.
Look at him go. Well, this is a perfect time.
Oh, he has like a weapon. I thought he was going to go get like a newspaper or something. He's got a spray.
He's sneaking up on it.
Oh, shit.
Tilt this up, dude.
What?
Get it!
What? So Phil shot the spray, and then I guess the spider fell down because then Phil went for the fucking double tap.
Yeah, it's an inch. Yeah, Dave.
Is it gone?
An interesting technique. Go spray, then I
don't have a spray. Yeah, I just grab whatever is the thing that most approximates paper nearest me, and I just whack it.
Yeah. Give it a squish. Yeah.
Hopefully there's a magazine I'm done reading or like a bill or something.
You get it? Phil, did you get it? Oh, he's running.
I think he got it.
I don't know. He's running so fast.
Either he's running away to throw it away or the spider has now taken control of the desk.
Spider comes on the podcast. It's like, oh, you know, back in 78, I saw The Jerk in theaters.
Yeah, the spider. Hot
Rod. What is going on?
What the hell? Phil has returned with a different weapon of spider battle. The spray didn't do it.
Look at him.
Phil came back with a compressed air container.
Oh, we should keep this on the podcast.
What is happening? And then he looked around the room like, did I get it?
Now he's just walking back.
All right. Which Phil's now returning.
Makes me think this might have gone okay.
How big was the spider?
All right, I think it's dead.
How big was the spider, Phil?
It was big. And it was big and black. And I was just, it was very unsettling.
Did it have teeth?
A real California spider. I've never seen somebody employ compressed air to battle
That was Raid.
Oh, but what? Oh, it had the little, the little compressed air looking hose on the end.
Yeah.
So you had, what was the first spray? You used two different sprays.
Yeah.
The first one was this like moth thing that we have a lot of moths. So I felt like I would.
Spider's not going to get taken down by some bitch ass moth spray.
No, I know, but I knew that it would get
him up. I get it. Yeah.
But I knew that it would get him down. And the Raid, I didn't want to like go crazy spraying Raid all over this.
Interesting. So
I wanted to get him down.
I question your story. I feel like if this was your real plan, you would have come back with this moth spray and the Raid instead of having to do that hilarious run that you did. I think the plan changed midway through.
Yep.
Doesn't check out, bro. I'm like Vinny. It's like, oh, it's under there's a secret compartment.
Well, here's ultimately what happened. I sprayed it. I really kind of drowned it in the moth stuff, but it was still moving.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I got to bring out the Raid in order to really kill it.
That's reasonable.
So so Kenny and I, while you were doing battle, Phil, Kenny and I were talking about how we would just smash that spider. But you prefer a chemical based
execution. Well, because my fear was that it was like a Black Widow or something, and I didn't want it to bite me.
Oh, okay.
I mean, look. No one I'm on board that. With that.
Yeah.
You guys are going to leave this in, right?
Yeah, no, this is all staying in. All right. Well,
funniest movie you've ever seen in theater?
Oh, I think Bridesmaids might have been...
Good answer.
Might have been the one that had the most like boisterous... And part of it, I think a little bit was, I went to see, like, it was an early screening, but it was like a week before or something like that. So I think it was a lot of like, people weren't really sure what this movie was type of thing. Whereas had I seen it in the theaters, I don't know. It was, but yeah, no, had I seen it regularly, which I did, but afterwards. Yeah, yeah, it was just a, it was
that a gut buster.
That's a gut buster. What about you, Kenny?
Borat.
Sure.
Borat was the funniest movie I'd ever seen in the moment. I spent the entire movie in a puddle.
I wish I got, I am allergic to pranks. I hate pranks. I hate when people are tricking unaware parties. So sure. Borat, I respect the hustle, but it makes me so uncomfortable that I have a hard time, unless they're pranking someone who's like a out and out.
Sure.
Horrible racist. Like when he, because there's a few times in those movies and particularly in Bruno, when he is pranking people who I don't necessarily think deserve to be made look like the world's biggest buffoons on 3,000 screens. That makes me a little bit uncomfortable. But that's just my thing. I don't like Punked either. Or was the thing? The thing where they hurt themselves?
Jackass. Where they hurt themselves.
I never liked Jackass. I just have a personal aversion to pranks.
I hear you, and I generally agree. But I think you kind of answered the, you know, or filled in the blank for me, which is I think the people in Borat really deserve it, and it's so cathartic.
By and large, yeah.
Seeing these racists getting their comeuppance in the way they do, like lulling them into a false sense of security to be as racist as they want to be is fucking so. It's so gratifying.
Yeah.
As someone who always suspected that's what happened in those behind those closed doors to actually see it. Mm-hmm. It's like that plus the humor of it, plus the character. The bigness of it. Borat was my least of the three, my least favorite character on that show, which I love, but the movie, he's the best one for a movie.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, that was great, guys. Awesome. Thank you so much, Clay, for showing up.
Thanks,
Clay.
Good hang.
Hey guys, I'll catch you later. Do you remember when we were talking about later. Sea of Love?
Yeah. Sea of Love about, I don't know, 45 minutes ago. Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much, Clay, for showing up for this. And we hope to have you back in the future for, I don't know, we'll find something else. It'd be great.
Anytime, guys. If you can, yeah, anytime you dig up some fucking weird movie no one else likes, I'm your guy.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Ethel Baby fish mouth.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.